So as I said, this is a little bit of a tricky passage. And you see that because, okay, is the person talking just a stand-in for Israel? Because that happens a little bit. But then there's a lot of I language, and Israel's not really talking. It's some servant of God talking. And then there's a dialogue, but the dialogue doesn't really make that much sense either, because why is the servant talking about how he was called out of the womb by God to God? And so all of that, if you look at it in a straightforward way, does not make a lot of sense. And so the answer, of course, is to not look at it in a straightforward way. That this is one of those passages that has, I suspect, many layers of meaning. The commentators don't really have a full agreement on what's being said. But the thing I want to pull out here is that this text serves differently depending on who you are and what your circumstances are in listening to it. Because, of course, to the tribes of Israel, to the Jews in ancient Israel, we have a pretty standard listing of bona fides. Usually, prophetic statements will, or frequently, they will start out with some thing establishing the legitimacy of the speaker. And of course, this is just rhetoric 101, right? Like, you don't want to go in somewhere and say, I'm going to talk to you about these things that I know nothing about. No, you don't say that. You say, I know lots about these things that I know nothing about because of all these things that happened to me. And that's what's happening here. So he says, I was called out of the womb. I have an authentic call. I am one called by God to give this message. And it goes on to say, ah, yes, but Israel has been faithless. I have failed in my job of bringing Israel back to God. If you are in Israel, this should be a warning to you. Say, hey, wait a minute. Are you talking about us now? That's the insider group there saying, oh, he's criticizing our behavior right now. Maybe we should listen to what he wants to do and we can agree or disagree. But then he moves on. He moves on past the hearing of the local tribes of Israel to this other message. Because if you think about sort of a standard view, and to call anything a standard view in ancient Israel is simplifying matters enormously. It's like saying the standard Christian view in Ankeny, and you go down the street and everyone disagrees. But if you think about sort of a general view, things that are agreed upon, they would say, well, God has a covenant with Israel. And the covenant is, he will be our God, it's very masculine this time, and we will be God's people. And that's the covenant. Well, what this prophet does is go on and say one more thing, which is, God told me right here in this writing that I will be a beacon to all of the nations. And specifically, the way this wording works, it's all the people who are not Jews. And my job here is to convince everyone, to be a beacon, to show everyone that this is the God of righteousness for us all. And kings will rise up in my presence, or in this presence, and princes will bow down before this person who spreads the righteousness of God elsewhere. And so if you're outside of Israel, that's a very different perspective, especially if you're outside of Israel and you feel you're downtrodden, saying, oh, this person is promising that there will be a change, that kings will bow down before this God. And so maybe there's some hope. But at the same time, it's a warning to kings. Hey, are you mistreating Jews in your little domains? Well, this God of righteousness does not just affect the borders of Israel. It will reach out beyond that, and justice will come everywhere. And I've given you this long story about Isaiah because it is Martin Luther King Jr. weekend. And the same things that were going on in the prophecy in ancient Israel went on in the prophecy in modern America too. It's a fascinating thing to read different sermons by Dr. King. And when I say different sermons, in the height of his powers, he had about six sermons that he went out and gave in different places, but he tailored them all to his audience. Again, Rhetoric 101. But it's a fascinating thing to read them because it reminds us that while we have a holiday now and we have certainly what seems to be a consensus view of Martin Luther King Jr., in the time, it was very different. The things he said to his black congregation in Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta and to other churches he went to, while the themes were the same, were given in a different way because the assumptions of his congregants were different from the assumptions of, say, the people that gathered at the General Synod of the UCC at which he spoke. They had an experience of life that was different, by and large, from the experience of life of people in the UCC gathering to hear him. And so reading them side by side can be an instructive first lesson in remembering that. And why is that important? Because so much of his message, the fierce urgency of now in his words, that we must have change, we must have justice for the Negro, as he said, so much of that can be interpreted in different ways depending on your perspective. And that's what we have now. We have a bunch of assumptions that we still carry around with us because of the experiences we live, and they are still different from the assumptions that most of the African Americans in this country have. And our assumptions, my assumption, is not the same as Pat's assumption, and so any two people have different assumptions. But a lived experience can be radically different depending on who you are and where you're from. You know, an interesting perspective we have is we have a governing structure in the United States. We have the United States Senate, the world's greatest deliberative body, celebrated in civics classes everywhere for its commitment to having long civil debate. Well, through the filibuster and through supermajority rules, the United States Senate was also the way that slavery was extended until a time passed when a majority of people in the United States thought it should end. And eventually, when the people who had been holding out discovered that they had lost even a supermajority to a supermajority in the Senate, that's when secession happened and the Civil War started. So on the one hand, we have this institution that we see from one perspective as a great deliberative body. From another, it was a body dedicated to perpetrating injustice. Same thing, just depends on your lived experience. And part of that is all these institutions were built from a certain perspective. The Senate was built by white men. Does that make it bad? No, I quite like white men, thank you very much. I hope many of you too do too, especially Beth. But it means they're built with a certain perspective that makes it sometimes hard to see the other side. You know, I just bought a house this week. Yay! And because I was buying a house in Uptown Ankeny that did not have any covenants on it or any homeowners associations, it was a fairly straightforward thing. My friend Ben owns a house in Columbia, Missouri. He's a college professor. And when he signed the papers to buy his house, he had to sign a covenant that restricted him from selling it to black people. And he found this sort of outrageous, partly because the house was built in 1963, 16 years after such covenants were ruled unenforceable by the United States Supreme Court. What's the difference experience there? Well, my lived experience is, even if that had been there, I wouldn't have had to go there and say, oh, well, my neighbors don't want me here. I can just go, and if they don't want me here, I'm sure I'll find out about next year. But in the meantime, I could just buy the house. But if a black professor tried to buy Ben's house, what message would he be getting right now about whether he's welcome in that town? It's a different experience that he has. We look at it and say, oh, the houses are for sale. If you have enough money, buy them. But that's not the experience everyone has, even today, because there are those things that are written down, and there are other things that we may not notice because they're not directed at us, but that still happened. And the effect of this is really uncomfortable for us because we didn't write that covenant. But by not being excluded by it, we benefited. Because we had more choices than other people did to buy homes. And this is sort of outdated, as I said. This is 60 years now since this was made unenforceable, but still, we didn't have to think about whether we should buy that house in the same way. We can choose to think about that, but we can also not think about it. And that's a thing called privilege. But it's an uncomfortable thing because even though we did not make the world like this, we still benefit from it. And that's really hard for all of us because we remember all the injustices that happened to us. We remember all the times that we have been treated unfairly. And it's really hard to stop and think, hey, wait a minute, I am a good person. I am a good intentioned person. And surely I cannot be making bad things happen. But that's the trick about these great institutions that we have, is that we all come in and play our parts. And that was what King was saying in his I Have a Dream speech, and that was what he was saying at General Synod. He was saying, it is a luxury to be able to walk away from these talks, to be able to walk away from matters of racial injustice. We can fool ourselves into thinking that we can walk away and it won't affect us. But that's an illusion. Because injustice ultimately is everybody's problem. On the very basic level, in a world in which there is injustice, it may just be a matter of time for each of us. That's a self-interested theory. And another way of thinking about it, do you want to benefit from injustice? Is that the message you want to live your life promoting? So King was saying, you white people who agree with me, because that's primarily who he was talking to, here are some things you can do to not be on the side of injustice. And back then it was things like the Civil Rights Act. You know, back then it was things about equality of pay. But now these things are creeping back up, and we can stand again and say, hey, wait a minute. Do these laws that are being passed affect white people and black people differently? Maybe not by the letter of it, but Social Security never discriminated between white people and black people by the letter of it. Yet, when it was first started, it did not apply to domestic workers who were and are disproportionately not white. So it's our job, if we want to honor Dr. King's legacy, and if we want to work on bending the arc of history toward justice, to pay attention around us and see what are the ways in which we could be promoting justice? What are our opportunities to do so? When can we look at it and say, I could walk away? Because our job is to not walk away, is to recognize it in front of us and stand up and say, I wish to bend the arc of history toward justice. And it starts every day by looking and listening and saying, what are the things that I hear that would not have been said if there were a woman here? What are the things that I hear that would not have been said if there were a black person here? What are the things that I hear that would not have been said if there's a Latino person here? And to say, well, when I hear them, maybe I can stand up and say, really? Is that what we think? And to challenge it. Make those things other people cannot walk away from, that other people must be aware of all the time, things that you are aware of all the time. It's hard. It's really hard. And we're not going to succeed all the time. But if we try, then that is our first step towards being a light for all the nations. For all the nations, like Isaiah wanted and like Dr. King lived. Amen.